There can be times when God in His mercy reveals His concern for us in some very dramatic ways. And I would hope that everyone here or everyone that hears this message later would have stories to recount of how God intervened in their lives in very dramatic ways, perhaps, but also in less dramatic ways. You know, sometimes we can see those dramatic things, and if we're not careful, miss the things that are less dramatic. But whether it's undeserved blessings or answered prayers or divine protection, without which our physical life may have even ended. But we have examples of God's concern for His people all throughout Scripture. But do you think that the times when God intervened in the lives of those righteous that we have recorded for us with miraculous events, that those interventions were only because they were special? Well, I'd like to begin today as we set the stage in Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11, of course, is known as the faith chapter. But I'm not going to read the whole chapter. I want to begin in verse 32, where Paul begins to make some of these concluding comments. So Hebrews 11 and verse 32, he says here, "And what more shall I say?" Because he's talked about Abraham, he's talked about Moses, he's talked about various others, a few others leading up to this point. He says, "For the time would fail to tell me." And he sort of summarizes a list of names here of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions. And there's some allusions here. Many say that this reference to stopping the mouths of lions refers to Daniel, of course, in the lion's den, that story. Quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Verse 35, women received their dead raised to life again. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. If we were to read this chapter more in depth, go through more of it, we would see that God didn't deliver all the righteous in their lifetime. We have those accounts. But what is also notable, to me about this faith chapter is that the names that are not mentioned. Paul summarizes some of them here, but there are a lot of names that are not mentioned. Joshua is not mentioned either. Elijah is not mentioned. Daniel, as I mentioned, is alluded to, but not directly. Isaiah is not mentioned either. You know, some very notable names that we would probably put in a list. But as he even said, he summarizes the end of verse 32, and the prophets. You know, none of them are mentioned. This chapter, though, is not meant to be exhaustive, in my estimation, or exclusive, but we can draw some great lessons from the righteous that are mentioned here. But there are also great lessons that we can learn from some of those that are not mentioned in this chapter. And one such individual is the prophet Elisha. Elisha was a prophet of God from roughly around 850 BC until 796 BC. What should our Christian life look like compared to someone like Elisha? Now, I'm not comparing in sense of whether we're as good as he is, if you will, but comparing in the sense of his walk before God, how he served God, how he yielded to God, and so forth. We know we're not supposed to compare ourselves, as Paul says. That's not the point of this message here today. But what we can do is learn from what is recorded for us, because God had a very special calling for him, but he also has a very special calling for us. So what we're going to do today is take a look at the life of Elisha. And the title of my message today is simply Lessons from the Life of Elisha. But let's set the stage here as we begin by doing a quick overview of his life. He certainly was a mighty prophet. His ministry, if you will, what we would call that, was much longer than Elijah's by about 30 years. There were 6 kings of Israel and Judah during the lifetime or the ministry of Elisha, compared to only 2 during the lifetime of Elijah. There were no other named prophets during the time of Elijah, while there were 3 during the time of Elisha. The other 3 were Obadiah, Joel, and Jonah. So you can get a sense of who his contemporaries were. There were only 14 of the 39 books that we have recorded in what we call the Old Testament that existed in the lifetime of Elisha, that included what is called the Torah, the 5 books of the Pentateuch, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1st and 2nd Samuel, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Solomon. There are about 16 miracle accounts recorded in Elijah's life, while Elisha performed around 21. Let's begin looking at his life then in 1 Kings 19, where we're introduced to him. 1 Kings 19, and we'll begin in verse 16. We read here, as it says, because of the sins which he had committed in doing the evil. Am I in the right spot? I'm sorry. I switched my numbers. 19:16, if I said something different, I apologize. 1 Kings 19:16. Also, you shall anoint Jehu. This is God speaking to Elijah. You shall anoint Jehu, the son of Nimshi, as king over Israel, and Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint as a prophet in your place. So, probably not the way you want to hear that you're going to die. But God says, okay, your time is coming to an end, so I need you to take care of a couple of other things here yet. So let's move down to verse 19. So he, Elijah, departed from there and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen before him, and he was with the 12th, the last team. And Elijah passed by him and threw his mantle on him, which seems like a very curious thing to do. We'll come back to that here in a moment. Verse 20. And so he, Elisha, left the oxen, ran after Elijah and said, please let me kiss my father and mother, and then I will follow you. And he says, go back again for what I have done to you. Basically, fine, yeah. Go ahead and do that. Verse 21. So Elisha turned back from him, took the yoke of oxen, slaughtered them, and boiled their flesh using the oxen's equipment, gave it to the people, and they ate, and he arose and followed Elijah and became his servant. So what is the first thing that we can learn here from Elisha's example? There was no hesitation. We read in Matthew 6:33 that we're to seek first God's kingdom, and we find here that Elisha had no hesitation when he was given the call, if you will, to serve God, to replace Elijah. He did what he needed to do. In verse 19, we're told that he was plowing with the 12th yoke of oxen, which meant that there were 11 others, which meant the family had some means. Elisha probably could have had a very comfortable life outside of what God wanted him to do. But we also see his selflessness here, in that he offered a sacrifice and allowed the people to participate in the fruits of it, if you will, to eat of the meat. In 1 Kings 20, then, God gave the Syrian king, Ben-Hadad, to Ahab, king of Israel, in battle. They had an ongoing conflict, Syria and the northern nation of Israel. And God told Ahab that he was to utterly destroy Ben-Hadad and Syria, but Ahab didn't listen to God. He let him go. In 1 John 2 and verse 3, let's read that. If you want to hold a marker here in 1 Kings, we'll be back there, but let's go next to 1 John chapter 2. 1 John 2 and in verse 3, we begin here where John writes, he says, now by this we know that we know him if we keep his commandments. He who says, I know him, and does not keep his commandments is a liar, and the truth is not in him. Ahab didn't keep the command of God. Now, we tend to think of the commandments that John's talking about here as just the 10. But we could open that up, if you will. We could expand that thought that it's all of God's instruction, even his direction, as he told Ahab, but even his direction, as he told Elisha through Elijah. Do we respond to God in this manner? Or do we resist at times like Ahab did? One of the interesting things that we can read in Scripture, we don't need to turn there, but in Genesis 6, when God is telling Noah that he was going to destroy the world, that Noah is to build this ark, the reasons why it needed to be done and so forth, we read in Genesis 6:22, it just says, simply says, thus Noah did. Noah was like Elisha. God told him and he simply said, okay, he went and did it. Are we like that? When God asks us to follow him, to obey him, to trust him, do we just do it? If we go back to 1 Kings 21, we find that Ahab kills and then takes the vineyard of Naboth. He had lusted after that, if you will. He went and cried to Jezebel, and she said, essentially, you're king, just go take it. But that's not what was to be done. God had divided the land up between the families within the tribes. And so Ahab did a very serious thing here. And then he repented. I suspect he knew all along it was the wrong thing to do when God called him on it. He did repent. So God said that the destruction of his household would not come in his lifetime. Because it seems that's why Ahab repented. God sent the prophet to tell him, all of your household is going to die because of this. And then he felt repentant. He felt bad about what he had done, which was a good thing, but it was still the consequence of what he had done. So then in 1 Kings 22, we have the recorded count of the death of Ahab in the battle he and Jehoshaphat, who was the king of Judah at the time, had with the king of Syria. But he died in that battle, as God foretold that he would die for his sins. So to pick up the story in 2 Kings 2 in verse 8, we find the transition then from Elijah to Elisha. 2 Kings 2 and verse 8, it says, now Elijah took his mantle, rolled it up, and struck the water, and was divided. This is the Jordan. This way and that, so the two of them crossed over on dry land. So some critics will say, well, this just happened to be there was some sort of landslide or something upstream, and the water stopped flowing. No, it says here it stopped on both sides. So it was very clear something dramatic had happened. But again, he takes this mantle, and some of the commentaries have an interesting thought. They said that oftentimes these mantles were sheepskin. So like a cloak, they would wear these things. And so it seemed to be a sign of the prophet, as we read back in 1 Kings, where Elijah put his mantle, his cloak, on Elisha. If we were to read, well, let's just turn there. Colossians 3 and verse 12. Colossians 3, verse 12, we read this as Paul writes. He says, therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, and suffering. This phrase, put on, in the Greek is very similar to just simply putting on a coat or a garment, something we would wear. Do we wear these things, these spiritual attributes, mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, like we would wear a coat? It's just second nature. It's there. It's part of us. As another reference, Titus 3:2 says something very similar, but expands it out to say, show humility to all men. Let's go back to 2 Kings 2 and in verse 9. After Elijah had struck this water, it says, and so it was when they had crossed over that Elijah said to Elisha, ask, what may I do for you before I am taken away from you? Well, that's a pretty interesting question there. Even as Elijah knew his ministry, if you will, is coming to a conclusion, he still was concerned for Elisha. It wasn't about who was the more important, who had the most recognition, position, or whatever. He says, what can I do for you before I'm taken away? And then Elisha makes a very interesting response here, doesn't he? He says, please let a double portion of your spirit be upon me. I've often pondered why he asked that. But he did. We have no answer directly. But it says, you've asked a hard thing, verse 10. Elijah says to Elisha here, nevertheless, if you see me when I've taken from you, it shall be so for you. But if not, that is, if you don't see me, it will not be so. And then it happened as they continued on and talked that suddenly a chariot of fire appeared with horses of fire and separated the two of them. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. And Elisha saw it and he cried out, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen. So he saw him no more, and he took hold of his own clothes and tore them in two pieces. The Targum translation of the Old Testament has this in a much more meaningful translation or wording, if you will. It says, my master, he was better to Israel by his prayers than chariots and horsemen. Which changes the whole understanding here, doesn't it? That Elisha was acknowledging that Elijah didn't have to do things like go to war and operate on that level, that his prayers, I mean, again, You look at the miracle accounts. In Elijah's life, we have 16 miracles recorded. That was because of the connection. A double portion in the Old Testament was the right of the firstborn. And this was not because they were better. They were first, simply. It's that the firstborn was to become the patriarch of the family. And he was to make sure that the family was taken care of. Was this part of what Elisha was asking for? Perhaps. But have you ever thought to ask God to have more of his spirit so you can serve him and his people? This was what Elisha was asking about. Whether we understand why he asked for a double portion, why not more, why not less, he was still asking so that he could do the job before him. And so then to continue here, in 2 Kings 2, verse 13, it says he also took up the mantle of Elijah. So he picked up, whether it was this sheepskin or whatever it was, he picked it up that had fallen from him. He went back and stood on the bank of the Jordan. He took the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him and struck the water and says, "Where is the eternal God of Elijah?" And when he also struck the water, it was divided this way and that, and Elisha crossed over. So he saw almost immediately that God was going to work with him in a very similar fashion as he did with Elijah. But we also have this aspect of succeeding generations being able to build on the previous. And let's look at this in John 14. Christ makes a very interesting statement here. In John 14 and in verse 12, Christ said this, "Most assuredly I say to you, he who believes in me, the works that I do, he will do also." Now, I've pondered that at times. There have been humbling times when I have anointed somebody and God has healed them immediately. And it's the kind of thing that makes the hair on your neck stand up almost. So I can appreciate some of this, but I've never cast out a demon. I've never done it to the level that Christ did. But he said to us, all of us, that we will do the same things that he did, notice, and greater works than these he will do, because I go to my Father, because Christ fulfilled the reason for coming in the flesh, died as our sacrifice, perfect sacrifice, that he and the Father could then send the Spirit, their Spirit, to work in us, that we would do greater things. So even collectively, look at what we're able to do as a church. There are very few countries in the world that we cannot reach with the gospel message. Usually those are nations that have terminated interaction, even on the level of like the internet, with the outside world. Places like North Korea. There are a few other nations like that. The challenge is, if they respond, we have nobody to send there. But they can still, they have a wealth of information and knowledge, don't they? The booklets, the magazines, everything that we've put in print, video. But think about what we've done. How far did Christ reach in his ministry? The focus was primarily on what we call Israel. But look at where we've been able to reach since the modern forms of communication have come on the scene. Christ knew that his disciples would do greater things because, as I said, through his death, God's Spirit would be given to his called out ones. And the called out ones have done some amazing things in preaching the gospel message, even down through time, if you look at that history since the first century, of serving God and demonstrating his way of life to the world. Let's go back to 2 Kings 2 and continue in verse 19. 2 Kings 2 and verse 19, it says, "Then the men of the city..." This was Elisha was essentially what we would call from our early history of this country a traveling minister. There were ministers that went around to areas that did not have either enough population or enough money. They could build a church, they could hire a minister. And so there were itinerant ministers that would travel. And in many ways, Elisha served the same function. So he's traveling here. He's near Jericho. It says the men of the city came to Elisha and said, "Please notice the situation of this place is pleasant, as my Lord sees, but the water is bad and the ground is barren." Now, some have wondered if this tainted water came from the curse pronounced on Jericho back in Joshua 6. But whatever the case was, the water was not potable. It wasn't usable to drink and cook in and so forth. So Elisha in verse 20 says, bring me a new bowl and put salt in it. And they brought it to him. And he went out to the source of the water, cast the salt in there, and said, thus says the Eternal, I have healed this water. From it shall no more be death or barrenness. So the water remains healed to this day, according to the word of Elisha, which he spoke. Now, salt can be very destructive. So the previous car I had, I sold a year ago, went down south. And when the person took it in to have some work on it, the mechanic says, this car's not from around here, is it? Because they could see underneath, even though I tried to take care of it, salt still tries to do the corrosive action on the metal. They could see on the underside. So we're aware of that destructiveness. Salt water will do the same thing with cars and equipment that's around them. But salt can also be used as a purifier. The state of Wisconsin is one of the highest levels of iron in our water in the country. We have a lot of iron in the ground, and that's in our water as well. So I suspect most of us have a water softener. So there are pellets that you can get, but also a lot of that is salt that's in those pellets to help soften that water, take the hardness out of it, if you will. But also that can help with removing stains and cooking and other useful things for salt. But here's the question. Do we have a close enough relationship with God to know that he will purify bad things we might encounter? I mean, Elisha spoke for God here. We find no record that he said, hold on a second, went and consulted with God. He already had enough of a close relationship with God that he was confident he could speak on God's behalf. Do we have the same relationship? To continue in chapter 2 here, then in verse 23, we have the account of Elisha calling out these bears. And this has been a source of criticism to God and his way of life, because many will say, well, these were just children, and they didn't know what they were saying, and look how angrily Elisha responds. Well, let's just read the account. It says, then he went up from there, from Jericho, he went up to Bethel. And as he was going up the road, some youths came from the city and mocked him and said, go up, you bald head, go up. So he turned around and looked at them and pronounced a curse on them in the name of the Lord. And two female bears came out of the woods and mauled 42 of the youths. Then he went from there, from Mount Carmel, to there returned to Samaria. Now there are a number of interesting things to note here. Bethel was one of the two centers of false worship in the nation of Israel. When Jeroboam established the modern nation, he did two cities, Bethel and one. The other city is not named, it's the region. It was actually up in the tribal land of Dan. And these were to be the alternative locations for worship of God, and he even moved it off a month so they would have no reason to go down to Jerusalem. But they quickly became locations of worshiping false gods. These were centers of religious and moral corruption. And as I said, these verses are used to criticize God. Well, this is not the case. When you look at their criticism, it's not based on what is actually said here. They were telling Elisha to go up and die, because back in earlier part of chapter 2, we read, as Elijah was dramatically taken away. So they're essentially saying, go die like Elijah. They didn't want him around. This is a very disrespectful thing to say, at the very least. But also they were disparaging him. It says they mocked him, verse 23. This was not one comment and Elisha pronouncing a curse. This was a monologue directed at him to mock him. And so it then says that he pronounced a curse. It doesn't say his curse was that they would die by bears. It says God sent the bears. But also, one other thing to consider here, the Hebrew for the word children can mean a child, an infant, but it can mean all the way up to what we would call teenage. Okay, so if there were 42 of them out in a group, these were not five-year-olds. And 42 is a mob almost. This was not one or two, and they were goading each other on, and they said the wrong thing. They were old enough to be out on their own, not being directed by adults, and they knew what was happening around them and around the area. Hold your place here. We'll go to Acts 23. We have a statement here, a reminder to us especially how we should view the world around us. Because it's very easy to get angry. We see the news, we hear the reports, we see governments covering up things, we see corruption, we see business that is just, you know, out for money, hurting people. All of these kind of things we can become very angry at, but we have a reminder here in Acts 23, verse 5, where Paul says, I do not know, brethren, whether he was the high priest, for it was written, you should not speak evil of the matter. So in this account, he was struck. Paul was struck here, and he basically cursed them. He said, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall, in verse 3. And then he retracted it because he realized it was the high priest that was saying this. Now, what he said was not wrong, if you will, but he realized it was disrespectful to authority God had allowed to be established. We have a similar statement in Titus 3, verse 2. And in James 4, verse 11, we're told, do not speak evil of each other. This is rulers as well as each other. Because who allows these things to be established? Who ultimately, as it says, places and removes? It's God. So let's go back to 2 Kings 3 and pick up the account in verse 16. We have the story here of Moab, who had been a vassal state with the nation of Israel. They were rebelling, and they were going to send their army to fight Israel. And so to kind of break in the account in verse 16, here is Elisha telling them what they should do. He says, thus says the Eternal, make a valley full of ditches. That can seem like an odd thing. What if you had an army coming at you and the prophet of God standing there? What should we do? Go dig some ditches. He says, for thus says the Eternal, you shall not see wind or see rain, yet the valley will be filled with water, so that you, your cattle, your animals may drink. And this is a simple matter in the sight of the Eternal. He will also deliver the Moabites into your hands. Verse 19, you shall attack every fortified city then, every choice city, cut down every good tree, stop up every spring of water, ruin every good piece of land. And so it happened in the morning when the grain offering was offered that suddenly water came by the way of Edom, and the land was filled with water. And when all the Moabites heard that the kings had come up to fight against them, all who were able to bear arms and older were gathered, and they stood at the border. And notice that the nation didn't even have to do anything here. They rose up early in the morning. The sun was shining on the water, and the Moabites saw the water on the other side as red as blood. Sometimes in those morning and evening twilight times, the sun can really change the color of things. And they saw this water as blood. And it says, this is blood. The kings have surely struck the swords and killed one another. Therefore, Moab to the spoil. Okay, we didn't have to do anything, but let's go plunder what's left. And so when they came to the camp of Israel, Israel rose up and attacked the Moabites. So they fled before them. They entered their own lands, killing the Moabites. And they destroyed as God told them to do. They threw a stone on every good piece of land and filled it. They stopped the springs, the waters, cut down the trees, and so forth. Verse 26, and when the king of Moab saw the battle was too fierce for him, he took his 700 men who drew swords to break through to the king of Edom, but they would not. And so then he took his oldest son who would have reigned in his place and offered him as a burnt sacrifice, which is an awful thing to do. God, again, told Israel not to do those things, but God delivered the nation of Moab to Israel, and Israel, all they had to do was dig some ditches. God miraculously filled them with water and delivered them into their hands. Then in chapter 4, we have the story of the widow's oil. In verse 1 of chapter 4, 2 Kings, it says, a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, saying, your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that your servant feared the Eternal. And the creditor is coming to take away my two sons to be his slaves. The only thing she had left was the value of her sons as servants. There was no safety net. There was no Social Security or government programs that could assist her. So Elisha says to her, what shall I do for you? Now, this is not cheeky. This is a statement or a question of concern. What can I do for you? He recognizes she's in a tough spot. He says, tell me, what do you have in the house? What can God work with? Whatever we have. Doesn't matter what we have. God can work with whatever there is. So she said, your maidservant has nothing in the house but a jar of oil. Now, how big would this jar be? I don't know. Quart? Whatever. That's all she had. So he says, go borrow vessels from everywhere, from all your neighbors, empty vessels. Do not gather just a few. In other words, whatever you can put your hand on, get as many pots as you can. And when you have gathered, come in. You shall shut the door behind you, your sons. You pour it into all these vessels and set aside the full ones. And so she went from him and shut the door behind her and her sons, who brought the vessels to her, and she poured it out. We go back to the earlier account. She just did. She didn't question, what good is this going to do me? But I can only imagine what the thoughts going through her head as she takes this jar, however big it is, and she starts pouring. And she's pouring, and she's pouring, and she's pouring, and she's pouring. And it's obvious there's more oil coming out of this than could ever be inside it. And so it says, it came to pass when the vessels were full, she said to her son, bring me another. She was not quitting. She was ready for more. Bring me more. And they said, that's it. There's not another vessel. So the oil ceased. She came and told the man of God, and he said, go sell the oil, pay your debt, and you and your sons live on the rest. As I said, this reflects the same lesson earlier as of doing. God promised in a number of places. Deuteronomy 31 verse 8 is one such place where he says that he will not forsake us. She cried out initially, you know, what can I do? God did not forsake her, did he? Do we trust in God, especially when a situation might seem hopeless? There have been times in my life I've done that. You lose a job and you have no idea. And it's over the Sabbath or the holy days. You know you're doing the right thing. But still, it's uncertain, isn't it? What will happen moving forward? And God always delivers. Not always in the way we think, but he always delivers. Psalm 91, verse 2, let me just read that to you. David wrote, I will say to the Eternal, he is my refuge and my fortress, my God. In him will I trust. We're going to need this relationship with God, this trust in God, this confidence that he will not forsake us more and more and more as we move forward. Because the world is just getting more and more and more chaotic and weird. There's no reason. There's no facts even many times. But let's continue here in 2 Kings, this time chapter 4, verse 16. This is the Shunammite woman. And he said that he had, as I said, he was like a traveling minister. And as he would go through this certain area, there was this couple that would open their home up to them. They seemed to be doing well. He would come through the area so much that they set up a room for them, for him, that he could just use when he was coming through the area. And so then in verse 14, he said, what can be done for her? His servant Gehazi said, well, she has no son. So this is why we pick up in verse 16 his statement here. He says then to her, about this time next year, you shall embrace a son. And she says, please do not lie to me. The indication is that she knew she was past the time of life where she could have children. And she's saying, essentially, don't tease me with such a thing. That's not a joke. But then, verse 17 says, the woman conceived, bore a son, when the appointed time had come of which Elisha had told her. The promise was true. They now had someone to take care of them in their old age, something they had never expected would come. God regularly reminds us in his word that he chooses with whom he will work, but it's not always who we think it should be or the way we think it should be. Let's turn to 2 Peter 3. 2 Peter 3 and in verse 9, Peter writes this, the Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering towards us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. God showed this Shunammite woman that even though she didn't expect this, that he would do something miraculous through her. But the reason why God works with any of us, especially those of us that are called, and we still go through trials, I mean, I can understand what this Shunammite woman is going through. She probably longed for a child for years and years and years, and to know then that would never happen, and then to have it happen. God allows trials in our lives, as we read here in 2 Peter 3, verse 9, that we would all come to repentance. Additionally, that we would learn more of how to become like him. But we look at the world around us, and it's easy for us to say, well, they don't deserve whatever. They don't deserve God's blessing. They don't deserve, you know, to not go through trials. They don't deserve to not be punished or whatever it happens to be. But, I mean, should Putin have the opportunity to repent? A lot of people don't think he should ever be given that opportunity. And he's done great harm. I'm not minimizing that. But we need to remember how God looks at mankind. What about Chairman Xi of China or Hitler or Stalin or many of these despotic rulers? We have to consider that, because then how do we consider God views us? To continue in 2 Kings 4 then, in verse 18, it says, the child grew. And it happened one day that he went out to his father, to the reapers, and he said to his father, my head, my head. So he said to his servant, carry him to his mother. Something was off. So he says, take them back to the house. When he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her knees until noon, and then he died. We're not told what the problem was, but he died. Now, can you feel the emotions going through the mother? This child she never thought she would have, never asked to have, that she had. We're not told how old the boy was, but let's just say he was 10. For 10 years to raise this child, to have all the love and joy that all came from that, and then to have him die on her knees. And so she went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God, this room that they had set aside for Elisha, shut the door on him and went out. And she called her husband and said, send one of the young men with one of the donkeys that I may run to the man of God and come back. She had not even told him yet. He was busy in the fields. He didn't know the son had died. She says, I need a donkey to go fetch Elisha. And so he says, why are you going to see him today? It's neither the new moon or the Sabbath. And she said, it is well. She had a thought in her mind. She's not just not telling him. She wanted to test something first. So she saddled the donkey, it says in verse 24, and to their servant said, drive, go forward. Do not slacken the pace for me unless I tell you to. The expression that we have, I don't know how familiar it is with you, but, you know, beaten like a rented mule. You know, you're going to drive that animal. There is no pausing. So she says, we're going, don't stop. And so then verse 25, she departed, she went to the man of God at Mount Carmel. She knew where he was. And it says, when Elisha saw her afar off, he says to his servant Gehazi, look, the Shunammite woman, he recognized her. Go run and meet her and say to her, is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with your child? The genuine concern that Elisha had here for these individuals. So Gehazi runs. And when he asked these questions, she said, it is well. Now she came to the man of God at the hill and she caught him by the feet. She didn't say anything. She comes up, she falls before him, grabs his feet. Gehazi comes near to push her away, but Elisha says, leave her alone. Her soul is in deep distress and the Eternal has hidden it from me and has not told me. I would hope that all of us with God's Spirit would have had experience at times when there's that, as it says for Elijah, that still small voice. Something's not right, or we know that we need to do something, that God through his Spirit is speaking, if you will, to us in that way. Elijah didn't have this at this moment. And so she finally says, did I ask for a son of my Lord? Did I not say, don't deceive me? Elisha then says to Gehazi, get yourself ready and take my staff in your hand. He knew now this terrible thing had happened. So he tells Gehazi, get yourself ready, take my staff in your hand, be on your way, and if you meet anyone, don't greet them. If anyone greets you, don't answer him, but lay my staff on the face of the child. And the mother of the child said, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you. The indication being that Gehazi was supposed to take her as well. She said, I'm not going with Gehazi unless you come. So he arose and he followed her. And Gehazi went ahead of them and laid the staff on the face of the child, but there was neither voice nor hearing. Therefore he went back to meet Elisha and told him, saying, the child is not awakened. When Elisha came to the house, there was the child lying dead on his bed. He went in, therefore, and shut the door behind the two of them and prayed to the Eternal. And he went up and lay on the child, put his mouth to his mouth, his eyes in his eyes, his hands on his hands, and he stretched himself out on the child, and the flesh of the child became warm. And from this I gather this was not a small child. So he begins to see a response here, verse 35. He returned, he walked back and forth in the house, he went up again and stretched himself out on the child, and the child sneezed seven times and opened his eyes. And he called Gehazi and says, this call a Shunammite woman. So he called her, and when she came to me, he said, pick up your son. So she went in and fell at his feet, bowed on the ground, and picked up her son and went out. In 1 Corinthians 15, one such place, we have other places in Scripture, we're told of the promise of resurrection, not just to life, the resurrection to eternal life. We have examples such as this to know that God does perform this. He can perform this. And we also then have an insight. Can you imagine the joy that she felt after that loss? And the joy that everyone, not just us, everyone will have when they meet loved ones again they thought they would never, ever see again, or worse, would be in some awful place of punishment. We have that hope. We have that reminder. To continue in verse 38 then, it says, Elisha returned to Gilgal, and there was a famine in the land. The sons of the prophet were sitting before him and said to his servant, put on a large pot and boil stew for the sons of the prophet. So one went out to the field to gather herbs and found a wild vine, gathered it from it a lap full of wild gourds, and came and sliced them in the pot of stew. They did not know what they were, though. When he served the meat to the men, it happened as they were eating that they cried suddenly and said, man of God, there is death in the pot, and they could not eat it. They didn't know. Evidently, the one that went out to cut the wild gourds didn't know. But as I can say sort of jokingly, I bet they never asked him to fix the meal again. But notice what Elisha did. He says, bring me some flour and put it in the pot. Now, there's nothing magical in the flour. It's the relationship with God. Serve it to the people that they may eat. And there was nothing harmful in the pot. These were other prophets. They're unnamed, but men serving God. And again, God took care of them. We have a promise in Mark 16, verse 18, where Christ said that nothing would hurt them. I'm reminded of the story of Paul when he was shipwrecked. And they were around the fire. They're cold, they're wet, they're trying to get warmed up and dry out their clothes. Paul reaches to pick up a piece of wood, and the viper bites him on the hand, and they all thought he's a dead man. And he simply shakes the snake off into the fire and goes on like nothing happened. Again, not that we demand of God, but that we can know with confidence that when we obey him, he promises to take care of us. It's a promise that we can claim. So then in verse 42, Elisha feeds more than 100 men. So he came to Baal Shalasa, brought the man of God bread of the first fruits, someone that came to honor him. 20 loaves of barley bread. Now just remember back earlier, there's a famine in the land. But he brings 20 loaves of barley bread, newly ripened grain in his knapsack, and he says, give it to the people that they may eat. This is given to Elisha, and what's Elisha's first thought? Share it with others. The blessings that we receive in life, do we share with others? Because when we do, when those blessings especially are from directly from God, because of what we're doing to honor Him, serve Him, obey Him, He always brings back more. So He says, give it to the people. Verse 43, His servant says, what? Shall I set this before 100 men? I mean, how thin do you have to slice 20 loaves to feed 100 men? He said again, give it to the people that they may eat, for thus says the Eternal, they shall eat and have some left over. So He set it before them, they ate, and they had some left over. I'm reminded of the boy that had the fish and the loaves. Always find that story curious too. It doesn't seem they asked the boy if they could take what he had. But he seemed to give it. Christ feeds the thousands. He ends up with more baskets than he had to begin with, to take back home or wherever he was going. Again, these blessings that God multiplies of things. Verse 1 of chapter 5, then, we come to the account here of Naaman. Naaman was a general for the Syrian army. These were mortal, hated enemies of the nation of Israel. So verse 1, Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, a great and honorable man in the eyes of his master, because by him the Eternal had given victory to Syria, was also a mighty man of valor, but notice, a leper. And so in the course of wars and these raids, verse 2, they had gone out, they brought back a captive, a young girl of the land of Israel. She waited on Naaman's wife. She became a slave, basically. Then this girl says to her mistress, Naaman's wife, if only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, for he would heal him of his leprosy. So Naaman went in and told his master, this is the king, thus and thus says the girl who is from the land of Israel. And the king of Syria said, go now, and I'll send a letter to the king of Israel. So he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. This is not a small gift. So he brings the letter to the king of Israel, and he freaks out because he thinks this is a trap. How am I going to heal this guy? So it happens, verse 7, when the king read the letter, he tore his clothes and says, am I God to kill and make alive that this man sends this man to me to heal him? Therefore, please consider how he seeks a quarrel with me. He's just setting me up to have a reason to be angry and come fight me. So Elisha, verse 8, hears the man of God heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, and so he sent a query basically saying, why have you done this? Naaman went with his horses, verse 9, and his chariot. He stood at the door of Elisha's house. Elisha sent a messenger. Elisha didn't even go out. This is probably the number two guy in Syria, and he's thinking, you know, he's going to come out, and he's going to be all dressed up, and he's going to say all these things and go all through the stuff. He's going to, you know, put an impressive show on here, and I'll be healed. No, Elisha sends a messenger. It says, go wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh will be restored to you, and you shall be clean. Leprosy was not, this type of leprosy was not something they would be healed of. They didn't have the ability to do that then. But Naaman's mad, verse 11, he's furious. He went away and said, I said to myself, surely he'll come out, he'll stand, he'll call the name of the Eternal and wave his hand over the place and heal the leprosy. You know, again, he was looking for something very dramatic. But he didn't get that. So verse 13, the servants come to him. You know, nobody's happy in that household because he's so upset, right? He's probably going around kicking things and mumbling and screaming at people. You know, this is not the way it was supposed to have worked out. So his servants, though, come to him. They're brave enough, and they said, if the prophet had told you to do something great, would you not have done it? How much more so when he simply says, go wash and be clean? I mean, it's not hard. Just try it. So he went down, dipped 7 times in the Jordan, according to the saying of Elisha, and his flesh was restored. Notice, like the flesh of a little child, that clean, soft, fresh smell. And he says, as the Lord lives before whom I stand, I will receive, I'm sorry, I skipped ahead. Verse 15, he returned to the man of God and his age, he came and stood before him and he said, indeed, now I know there is no God in all earth except in Israel. Now, therefore, please take a gift from your servant. Remember, he took all this gold, all this silver, all these clothing. And Elisha says, no. As I stand before the Eternal, I will receive nothing. Naaman urged him. He still refused. And so Naaman said, well, then, if not that, please let me take 2 mule loads of earth. Why would he ask that? Because the expectation in the land, in this area of this time, was that the gods were tied to a specific area. So if this was the God of Israel that had done this, he's not in Israel, is he? He lives in Syria. So if I take all this dirt back with me, God will come with me. But he also says, may the Lord pardon your servant when my master goes into the temple of Rimmon to worship there, and he leans on my hand, and I bow down in the temple of Rimmon. When I bow down to the temple, it is, may the Lord please pardon your servant, because he says essentially, I'm doing it to serve my master, not because I'm worshiping the God. And Elisha says, go in peace. He worked with him where he was. Even when we're not completely just before God, he still expresses our mercy to us. He had no reason to intervene in Naaman's life, but look at the impact that had. Look at the impact Elisha's name already had in the region. And I've often wondered, and this can apply to all of us, how much impact we have without even really realizing it. The people that watch us, what we do, they listen to what we talk about, how we talk, they look at how we behave, whether we're honest or not, they pay attention to us because we are different. And maybe God will use that in the future. We're blessed also when we repent. We see that in all of these examples we've gone through. And then we have the follow-up. After Naaman's dramatic healing, Gehazi thought, man, Elisha sure left a lot on the table there. Maybe just a little bit of it is okay. So verse 20, Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, look, my master has spared Naaman the Syrian while not receiving from his hands what he brought. But as the Eternal lives, I will run after him and I will take something from him. So Gehazi pursued Naaman. I mean, even that's impressive. How fast do you have to run to catch up with horses and chariots? But he catches up with him. Naaman sees him running. He gets down from his chariot and says, is all well? What's up? You know, you're running out here. Did I miss something? Whatever. Is there more? Gehazi says, all is well. My master has sent me, saying, indeed, just now 2 young men of the sons of the prophet has come to me from the mountains of Ephraim. Please give them a talent of silver and 2 changes of garments. It's just pocket change compared to what he had, right? Gehazi's surely thinking, well, that's not too much. Nobody will notice that much. But he lied, didn't he? He lied on the behalf, using Elisha's name. So Naaman said, all right, well, no, that's take 2, not just 1, take 2. He urged him, bound the 2 talents of silver in 2 bags with 2 changes of garments, handed them to 2 of his servants, and they carried them on ahead of him. When he came to the citadel, Gehazi, he took them from their hand and stored them away in a house, let the man go, and he departed. He didn't need them following him all the way back to Elisha. And when he went and he stood before his master, Elisha said to him, where did you go? I have no idea how often God has asked this, but this is not the only time this question has been asked. He asked Cain, where is Abel? Did God not know? Did Elisha not know, having a relationship to do all these amazing things that have been done? He knew. He wanted to see what Gehazi would say. God, where did you go, Gehazi? And he says, your servant did not go anywhere. I've not been gone. But then Elisha says, did not my heart go to you when the man turned back from his chariot to meet you? Is it time to receive money and receive clothing, olive groves and vineyards, sheep and oxen, male and female servants? Therefore, the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and your descendants forever. And he went out from the presence leprous, white as snow. We are not to be focused on the things of this world right now. That is not what God promises us. He promises us the world to come, the kingdom to come. And he says, I'll give you even more then. Because wealth can change things. Doesn't always, doesn't have to, but in a lot of cases it does. Maybe Gehazi was looking for his retirement fund here. What am I going to do when Elisha's gone? But it wasn't the time, as he says there. That's not what he should have been focused on. we have to be careful that we're not the seed that falls amongst the thorns, as we read in Luke 8, verse 14, where Christ talks about the seed that fell among the thorns, he says, are those who, when they heard, went out and choked with the cares and riches and pleasures of life, and they bring forth no maturity. Many, many of you, as I can, could probably recount name after name after name after name of people who started with us in this walk that are no longer with us because something else became more important. We have to remember what we're about, what God is offering. In chapter 6, then, here of 2 Kings, we have the miracle account of the floating axe head. And you might say, well, why did they care so much about an axe head? Well, the neighboring nations had withheld a lot of technology, if you will, and one of the things that they didn't want Israel to understand was how to make iron implements, because if you have iron, you can make weapons of war. And iron's a lot more durable than brass or bronze or some of these other metals. But there are other lessons here. So chapter 6, verse 1 says, the sons of the prophet said to Elisha, see now, the place where we dwell with you is too small for us. Please let us go to the Jordan, let every man take a beam from there, and let us make a place where we may dwell. They're asking for permission. They need more room. Would this be okay? But also notice they're not asking for someone else to do it. They're willing to go do the work themselves. And so he says, please let us go. And so he says, go ahead. So then one says, please consent to go with your servants. They wanted his presence, like the Shunammite woman. They wanted to know they were doing the right thing and that they would be blessed in what they would do. And so he says, I will go. So he went with them, and when they came to the Jordan, they cut down the trees. But as one was cutting down a tree, the iron axe head fell into the water. It came off the end of the axe and fell in the water. Again, this would be a very valuable tool. But also notice, he cried out and he said, alas, master, for it was borrowed. It wasn't even his. So the man of God said, where did it fall? And he showed him the place. So Elisha cut off a stick, threw it in there, and it made the iron float. The sticks don't make iron float. But again, it's a dramatic example of what God will do. There have been times, and it can seem rather silly to do this, there have been times when I've lost something very important. I need it for a reason, not just because I had it and I don't now. And I've prayed and asked God, show me where this is, please. And then in the course of some time, you know, whether it's the same day or the next day, it's like in the most obvious place that God can do these kind of things. And like I said earlier in the message, if we're careful, we can miss the small things that are really not the small things because we see God's hand in our life. So here Elisha says, once it floats to the top, he says, no, go pick it up. And so he did. He reached out and he took it. Now understand as well, the Jordan is not a pond. It's moving water. And it's sitting there for him to go grab it. The sons of prophets, as I said, were not depending on someone else. They needed space. They wanted Elisha's blessing. And this is not a minor thing. But we come to a really amazing story now in verse 8. It says, the king of Syria was making war against Israel. I mentioned earlier, they were constantly at battle with each other. They were next door. Syria was on the coastline. If you can picture, is northern tribes of Israel. You've got the Mediterranean, you had the nation of Syria, then you had the nation of Israel. So they were in close proximity. So it says, the king of Syria was making war against Israel, and he consulted with his servants, saying, my camp will be in such and such a place. And the man of God, this is Elisha, sent to the king of Israel, saying, beware you do not pass by this place, for the Syrians are coming down there. God, as the king would utter it, God would tell Elisha. Elisha told the king, this is what the king of Syria is doing, don't go there. It says, the king of Israel sent someone to the place of which the man of God had told him, and he warned him as he was watchful there, not just once or twice. So this happened several times. Therefore, the heart of the king of Syria was greatly troubled by this thing, and he called his servants and he says, okay, who's spilling the plans? right? Who's leaking all of this? Who's talking? He says, show me which one of us is for the king of Israel. And one of his servants says, none. Now, we're not told how he knew this, but he says, none, my lord, O king, but Elisha the prophet who is in Israel tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. That would be very scary, wouldn't it? If you're not following God and you suddenly realize it doesn't matter where I go, whatever I say, God's going to repeat to my enemy. So he says, go and see where that is, that I may send and get him. Meaning, if I take Elisha out of the mix here, then I can finally get to the king of Israel. And so they said, surely he's in Dothan. So he sent horses and chariots, a great army there, and they came by night, and they surrounded the city. And when the servant of the man of God arose early and went out, there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. And his servants said to him, alas, my master, what shall we do? We're surrounded. We're cut off. What are we going to do? Elisha answers and says, do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them. And they probably turn and look at him and think, did he sleep funny last night? Because he's speaking nonsense. So Elisha prayed and said, Lord, eternal, I pray, open his eyes that he may see. And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. More often than not, the battle before us is not our battle. It's God's. What he wants to see is whether we will trust in him. Elisha had complete confidence in God. He was not shaken. He already knew. And so it says here, verse 18, the Syrians came down to him, and Elisha prayed to the Eternal and said, strike this people, I pray, with blindness. Again, we see some awful things in the world, and as our first reaction, God, turn it to glass, kill them all. Or as our response, soften their heart and give them repentance. So he prayed for blindness, and God struck them with blindness according to the word of Elisha. And Elisha says to them, this is not the way. Did you know there's a Star Wars reference in Scripture? This is not the way. He's saying this to the men that are now blind. He says, nor is this the city. Follow me, and I will take you to whom you seek. They have not yet seen Elisha, but he's telling them, he's somewhere else. I'll take you to him. But instead, he led them to Samaria. This is the capital of the northern tribes. So not back to Syria, deeper into Israel. And so it was, verse 20, when they had come to Samaria, that Elisha said, O Eternal, open the eyes of these men that they may see. And the Eternal opened their eyes, and they saw, and they were inside Samaria. And you can imagine now the fear that just falls on them. They're dead men walking. When the king of Israel saw them, notice his reaction. He says to Elisha, my father, shall I kill them? And Elisha says, no, you shall not kill them. Would you kill those whom you have taken captive with your sword and your bow? Set food and water before them. They may eat and drink and go to their master. This is Christ saying, feed your enemies. Do good to those who spitefully use you. And the purpose is so we do not become like them. So, to the king's credit, he prepared a great feast for them all. After they ate and drank, they sent them away back to their master, and the bands of Syrian raiders came no more into the land of Israel. You killed them with kindness instead. And I'm sure that account, that story, if you will, was repeated for a long time, especially in Syria. But I'm also reminded of Romans 8, verse 3, the latter part, where Paul says that, what shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? To continue here then, in verse 1 of chapter 7. Well, before I leave that, let me ask one more question. When was the last time we prayed for an enemy? It's a hard thing to do, isn't it? But this is essentially what Elisha did here. He showed the enemy compassion, what they should be doing instead, led by example. So moving to chapter 7, verse 1. Elisha says, "Hear the word of the Eternal. Thus says the Eternal, tomorrow about this time, a sheah of fine flour shall be sold for a shekel." Because after the Syrians had forgotten the story of what Elisha did with the blindness and being compassionate, they returned to this matter of war. And so they had surrounded Samaria. They had cut it off. They had created a famine in the city. It had gotten so bad, he says, "Tomorrow this time, a sheah of fine flour shall be sold for a shekel," a huge amount, for a tiny little bit. Supply and demand. Almost no supply. Demand is high. It's expensive. Two sheahs of barley for a shekel. Barley is a lesser grain, if you will. It's coarser. It's not as tasty in different forms as flour would be. So he said, this is what it's going to cost. So an officer on whose hand the king leaned answered Elisha and said, "Look, if the Eternal would make the windows in heaven open, if you will, could this thing be?" He said, I don't believe it. I misspoke earlier. Verse 1 is how cheap it would be. So Elisha says to him, "You will in fact see it, but you'll not eat of it." So then we have the following account. We'll pick it up in verse 9. So the siege happens, famine's getting worse, and we have this matter of these lepers that realize they're dead men anyway. So they might as well go out and maybe plead their case with the Syrians. Perhaps they would live, they would have something to eat. If not, they would be killed. They're going to die anyway. So what do they have to lose? So verse 9, to break into the story, it says, let me continue. I didn't set the whole stage yet. They did go out, and they found the Syrian army gone. Everything was empty. All the stuff was still there. And so they begin to plunder. Woo-hoo, we've hit the jackpot. So they're grabbing food and clothes and, you know, precious things. And they're hiding them initially, and then they say in verse 9, "This is not right. This is a day of good news, and we remain silent. If we wait till morning light, some punishment will come upon us. If somebody else comes in here and sees what we're seeing, then we're going to be in trouble because we're not sharing. So let's go tell the king's household." So they went and called to the gatekeepers. They approach the city. It's all barred, you know, closed up. And they tell them, "We went to the Syrian camp. Surprisingly, no one was there. Not a human sound, only horses and donkeys tied, and the tents were intact." And the gatekeepers called out. They told it to the king. The king arose and said, "It's a trick." Right? "Let me now tell you what the Syrians have done to us. They know we're hungry. And when we've gone out up to the camp, they've hidden themselves in the field, and they'll catch us. So one of the servants say, well, then let several men take the five remaining horses left in the city, because they had eaten all the others. Let them take those horses, then go out, they'll check it out. If it's a trap, they'll die, but we're all going to die anyway. But if it's not a trap, then we'll prove that it's okay." So they did, verse 14. They took the two chariots and the horses, king sent them out. They went out. Verse 15, "And indeed the road was full of garments and weapons the Syrians had thrown away in their haste. And so the messengers returned and told the king. The people went out and plundered the tents of the Syrians. So a sheah of fine flour was sold for a shekel, two sheahs of barley for a shekel, according to the word of the Eternal that Elisha said in verse 1. But it says, so it happened, just as the man of God had spoken to the king, saying, two sheahs of barley for a shekel and a sheah of fine flour for a shekel. Then the officer who had answered Elisha said, now look, if the Lord would make all of this happen, how would it be? It happened to him, verse 20, that he was trampled in the gate and died. There was such a rush and crush of people to go grab the food and the things left by the Syrians that he died in the rush. But the famine was ended. Do we trust in God the same way? This man doubted. Doubt is the enemy of faith. Elisha knew, but this man doubted. In Exodus 23 and verse 22, God told Israel, he says, "If you indeed obey my voice and do all that I speak, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries." I mean, Israel had to do nothing here. God caused the army of Syrians back in verse 6 to hear a noise like another army coming, and they panicked and they fled. And Israel didn't have to lift a hand. In chapter 9 then, 2 Kings, in verse 1, Elisha is told to go anoint Jehu as king of Israel. Verse 2, he says, when you arrive at the place, look there for Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi. Go in and make him rise from his associates, taking him to an inner room. Take the flask of oil and pour it on his head and say, thus says the Eternal, I have anointed you king over Israel. And then open the door and flee and do not delay. So the young man, the servant of the prophet, went to Ramoth Gilead. When he arrived there, the captain of the army sitting, he says, I have a message for you, commander. Jehu said, for which one of us? He says, for you. He rose, he went to the house, he poured the oil on his head and said, thus says the Eternal God of Israel, I have anointed you king over the people of the Lord, over Israel. You shall strike down the house of Ahab, your master. Because this was the punishment God had pronounced on Ahab. That I may avenge the blood of my servants, the prophets, the blood of all the servants of the Eternal at the hand of Jezebel. For the whole house of Ahab shall perish. And so we see God being faithful here. Moving down to chapter 13, God being faithful to his words, what he says will come to pass, the punishment that will come. In 2 Kings 13, then in verse 14, this is the death of the Elisha. We come to the end of the account of his life. It says here, Elisha had become sick with an illness of which he would die. We don't know what that is, simply that he would die. And Joash, the king of Israel, came down to him and wept over his face and said, oh, my father, the chariots of Israel and their horsemen. This is the same statement Elisha made when Elijah was taken in the whirlwind. Your prayers had done more than the armies could have ever done. So moving down to verse 20. It says, then Elisha died, they buried him, and the raiding bands from Moab invaded the land in the spring of the year. And so it was as they were burying a man that had died from these skirmishes, a man of Israel. They suddenly spied a band of raiders, and they put the man in the tomb of Elijah. And when the man was let down and touched the bones of Elisha, he revived and stood on his feet. I find it interesting that even after his death, Elisha continued to have an impact. What legacy will you and I leave for those that follow us? The legacy of our calling, specifically. Are we living such a life of God that we will continue to be an example of righteousness long after we're dead? That's part of why I started in Hebrews 11. Look at the impact those individuals had. They may not have had wealth or power or recognition of name in their lifetime, but we still talk about them, don't we? We still learn from them and what God did through them. There's much that we can learn from reviewing the life of someone like Elisha. Each one of us is being prepared for our role, our part in being the bride of Christ. Each one of us is a vital part of that body now. May we all become better sons or daughters of God by remembering the lessons from the life of Elisha.